Good morning. We are back, Bostopia News with Evan George, to take a look overall at the transition and shift of Boston's nightlife. Now, this episode came about because I started reading The Combat Zone by Jan Brogan. It's great. I'm maybe 4 or 5 chapters in. And originally, I wanted to connect the rise and fall of The Combat Zone, and for those of you who don't know what it is, don't worry, I'll explain in a little bit, with Boston's current struggle to get more liquor licenses. That's originally the gap in the history that I wanted to tell. But as I read more about it and I thought more about it, I realized that there are many other historical events and concepts that people would need to understand to try to figure out why it is that Boston has to go begging to the State House for something so small as a liquor license. And to truly understand that phenomenon, you don't just have to know about the Combat Zone, though I think that actually plays somewhat of a smaller role in the overall picture. You also have to look at what happened to Boston in the transition when we ended Prohibition, so now we're in the 1930s, and then to understand that dynamic, and that is when the current liquor laws were established, and to understand the decisions that were made, you then need to look at the Irish political takeover of Boston of the early 20th century and the conflict between the Irish and a group of people referred to as the Brahmins. And in order to understand who the Brahmins are, you then need to go even further back and look at Irish immigration in the mid-19th century and a little bit of the Know-Nothing Party. And that is ultimately what this episode is going to do. This will be a fun little history of Boston, particularly the dynamics between the Irish working class and the Brahmins and how that relationship really codifies the ongoing relationship that Boston has with the State House. And you really can't understand why Boston is in the unique position of not getting to control many aspects of its own municipal government without really understanding that tension, conflict, and dynamic. But before we enter that way back machine, we need to get everyone on the same page with what is the current conflict in Boston trying to secure more liquor licenses. And here's where we hit one of our first big problems, is it's actually very difficult for me to figure out how many liquor licenses does Boston currently have. I'm going to just read from you a whole host of different articles, all written in 2023. Boston.com, June 27th. Of the 1,100 or so liquor licenses for restaurants, most are in use, but others may be held by landlords or restaurant owners waiting to be deployed when the timing is right, according to brokers and lawyers in the hospitality industry. Okay, 1,100 or so. Boston Globe, January 30th, 2024. So this is probably the most recent. Thanks to a 91-year-old state law, Boston has been at or near its quota for full liquor licenses, currently around 820 for many years. So for restaurants and bars looking to open in the city, existing licenses sell in a private market that set new price records in 2023, when sales ranged from about $400,000 to $600,000. The city also has around 390 limited licenses, such as beer and wine only. These go for $100,000 to $1,800,000 on the private market for roughly 1,200 licenses for restaurants and bars. So now we went from 1,100 to 1,200. And as you notice, part of the reason is there are many different types of liquor licenses. There's on-site, meaning you consume it on-site, so think of a bar or a restaurant. There are off-site, such as a liquor store where you can buy alcohol, but you're not popping bottles there, so on and so forth. And that also gets at one of the major problems that we have is that all of these licenses, once purchased, can then be resold on a private market. And we absolutely should not be allowing those, but this is one of the major hurdles as to us expanding it. Because if you have one of those licenses, well, the more scarce the licenses are, the more value it has. And so one of the biggest pressures that we have in not changing our current laws are bar and restaurant owners who, one, want the value of their liquor license to increase so that they can sell it and have a nice retirement, local economy be damned. And then also, two, these bars and restaurants sometimes fear competition. And I say sometimes because there are other bar and restaurant owners that realize that sometimes it is actually good for a local area to have more options because it'll just bring simply more people. Though others obviously don't have that same critique. And I'm sure there are many people and experts on the topic that will say one way or the other, it would be good to have more here, or vice versa, it'll be detrimental to have more here. Anyway, 1,100 to 1,200. Now we have in August of 2023, a GBH article, quote, currently the city's licenses are capped at about 1,400 by state law. And finally, just to put a bow on it, October 2nd, 2023, another GBH article, quote, it would represent a major boost to the number of liquor licenses available in Boston. Mayor Michelle Wu said the city now has a total of 2,200 licenses. So yes, we are like 5 minutes into this episode, and this is already very confusing. Because, again, there are many just different types of licenses. The ones that I am most focused on, or I think are the most pertinent, are the ones that are on-site consumption bars and restaurants. I think for most people, that's what we're talking about. If I had to guess, the 2,200 that Michelle Wu was talking about includes liquor stores. But I really don't know. Or maybe also includes temporary licenses. So for example, if there's like a fair, or, you know, sometimes they have like an open beer garden for like a week and they block off a part of City Hall. So like those temporary liquor licenses that you can sometimes get. So maybe that 2,200 is every single type of license Boston can possibly have. Our working number, we'll just say, is around 1,200. And I'm taking that from the most recent Boston Globe article that itself is very focused on the full liquor licenses, which will allow beer, wine, and malt. So just think of that as like beer, wine, and hard alcohol. They put that number at 820 plus an additional 390 limited licenses, just beer and wine, no hard alcohol, for a total of roughly 1,200. That's what we're going with for this episode. And to attempt to change this, to attempt to add more liquor licenses, the most recent fight back in March of last year, the Boston City Council unanimously approved, again, none of the home rule petition, which is when we have to go begging to the State House to allow us to do something, a petition which was asking the state to give us an additional 250 liquor licenses to very specific neighborhoods over the next 5 years. And this would focus on areas including Dorchester, Roxbury, Mattapan, Rosendale, East Boston, and Hyde Park. And I'm currently reading from a Sean Philip Carter article, Boston Herald of March 22. And almost most importantly, it would make 5 new non-transferable licenses available a year for 5 years for each zip code. So these are non-transferable, which means you do not have full ownership over the license. You don't get to resell it at a private market. And these are now going through the State House. This is from October 19th, 2023, Boston.com article. The bills, House Bill 3741 and Senate 2380, would follow along with this petition. So if you're curious, those are the House and Senate bill numbers. And the reason it is focused primarily on getting more liquor licenses to those particular neighborhoods is because, as I'm sure you can guess or know, most of the bars and restaurants are not in those areas. They are compacted in downtown, the Back Bay, and most notably the Seaport. So the Seaport increased or saw, and I'm just going to read you the quote, this is from Councilor Brian Worrell, we saw 70 liquor licenses end up in the Seaport neighborhood from 2000 to 2023. And those liquor licenses had to come from somewhere. Some of those licenses did come from Dorchester, Mattapan neighborhoods, Worrell said. So essentially, for that reselling on the private market, to the limited number that Mattapan, Dorchester, Roxbury, Rosendale had licenses, the restaurant owners who owned those licenses were simply able to sell them to the whole swarm of capital investment we saw in the Seaport for astronomical numbers, and they all just ended up there, which again, that never ever should be allowed because of how much it messes with local economies. You can't have small business owners making those type of decisions. And Worrell also continues, despite having only 0.5% of Boston's population, South Boston's waterfront has more than 15% of its liquor licenses in the city. Worrell said at a consumer protection professional licensor committee hearing on the bills earlier this month. Quote, meanwhile, Dorchester houses over 14% of all Bostonians and yet has less than 3% of its liquor licenses. And so this is incredibly important to get this done and to make sure that these licenses are in these neighborhoods. And now, what is the current state of those bills? Because the State House does not like to relinquish power and is, for some reason, is very hung up on granting Boston really the ability to do anything, but in this instance, more liquor licenses. Reading you back from the Boston Globe article, the most recent one, January 30th, 2024. Mara Healey has been the third straight governor to support letting cities and towns set their own quota rules, although she left the proposal out when filing the Municipal Empowerment Act in January. Her administration said it needed more time to get the, quote, language right, unquote. And while, as I stated previously, I think a lot of this is pressure from current small business owners across the state that don't want increased competition. They don't want more liquor licenses to be awarded because, again, it diminishes the value of their current licenses and creates theoretical competition in the same marketplace. Though, again, in terms of bars and restaurants, that is not an exact science. And as we've seen historically, before we get into the fun stuff, the State House is always wary of giving any power. And the current law, and maybe we'll just talk about it now, was established in 1933, which was for the end of Prohibition. And I'll read from you a 2016 article from Amanda Hoover in Boston Magazine. Much like our lack of happy hour, modern Bostonians have post-Prohibition Puritans to thank for the measly Boole's allowance. We're going to get into that history soon. Old school state legislators in the 1930s were distrustful and disapproving of a predominantly Irish city council, worried that Boston might be too lax when it came to restricting the number of bars in the city's limits. So Beacon Hill took jurisdiction over alcohol licensing, deciding they knew best about who should be pouring what drinks and where, rather than putting the power in the hands of municipal officials throughout the Commonwealth. Boston, a city now of full young professional students in walkable neighborhoods, is the biggest victim of the archaic state system. While any other municipality in the Commonwealth is allocated one on-premise license for every 1,000 residents and can request more as its population climbs, Boston isn't privileged to such increases and faces an arbitrary cap that legislators have upped only twice since 1933, once in 2006 and again in 2014. And it's so funny to actually see this written. So like in Section 17 of our general laws, I'll just read it for you. The local licensing authorities of any city or town, except the city of Boston, may grant one license under the provisions of Section 12, yada, yada, yada. Just explicitly saying, and it references except the city of Boston. Like if you just do like a simple search, like find the phrase except the city of Boston, just in this Section 17, it lists it five times. About all of it, again, everything involving liquor licenses. Each like almost paragraph just goes, here's the law, except the city of Boston, they can't do this. Or except the city of Boston, it's more strict in this area. And to go even further about how wild this is, how much Boston is targeted, unlike any other municipality in Massachusetts, is it wasn't until very fairly recently that we even got to appoint our own members on the licensing board. Reading from a 2011 Dorchester Reporter article, titled Patrick Hands Went to Menino, Let City Take Licensing Board. Governor Deval Patrick made a rare move last week. He relinquished control of a powerful entity, known for mounting takeovers of various boards and agencies and personally signing off on press releases. The governor filed legislation that would transfer control of the Boston Licensing Board to Mayor Thomas Menino, handing his honor the power to appoint the three-member panel. Patrick's legislation, filed Friday, would reverse a 1906 law that flipped control from the mayor to the governor as part of a power struggle between the Yankees and the Irish. And this is what I meant by the question of Boston liquor licenses. You have to keep going back for this all to make sense. why in 1933 was Boston singled out over every other municipality at the end of Prohibition? Why was it in 1906? I don't know why I keep saying oh weird. 1906, that powers that were once held by the mayor of Boston got ripped from them and taken to the State House. Do you see how this is all part of Boston's relationship with the State House? And you have to go back, right now we're in 1906, over a century, and we have to understand this dynamic between the Irish working class of Boston and the soon-to-be-discussed Brahmins. And I know I'm not going in, like, consecutive sequential order, so I'm sorry if this is, like, I'm being hard to track how I'm kind of going backwards and forwards simultaneously. But before we get to the Brahmins, we now need to go even further back in history. And this is as far back as I go, I'll promise. We need to look at the mid-19th century and the changing demographics of the city to, again, figure out, why is it that the Boston does not have control over its own city? And right now we're looking at that in terms of liquor licenses, and I also want this to be part of a larger narrative of Boston's nightlife. But again, for this all to make sense, or at least in my mind, we now got to go back to the 19th century and look at Boston. So I'm going to read from you a little bit from a PBS, this is just going to be very quick and generic. So many topics in this one episode really need their own episodes to flesh out. But right now, we're giving skim. I want everyone to have a loose historical understanding so that as we revisit these topics for months to come, people have some idea of like where things are related to each other. And this article is called Boston's Immigrant Population, PBS. I'm not sure when it was written. They don't have it listed. Boston did have its problems in the decades preceding 1850. It had illegal brothels and bad neighborhoods. The political cohesiveness of city government was showing cracks, but immigrants had never been a major problem. Immigrants had trickled in manageable numbers and were mostly skilled artisans who became good citizens. Most immigrants did not see Boston as an ideal stomping ground. There was little space and not enough industry to absorb them, so they moved on. As Oscar Hanlon wrote, two conditions were essential before a large immigrant group would stay in Boston. First, the immigrants must be more interested in escaping from Europe than what faced them in America. I want you to remember that immigration has almost always been a push factor, as it is today. People wanting or needing to get out of where they are, not because of the shiny, necessary opportunities that awaits them, though, you know, there is some correlation between the two. Anyway. Second, they must have so little mobility that once in Boston, they cannot go elsewhere because poverty deprived them of the means and the despondence of desire. For a long time, this combination of factors did not apply to any migration that affected Boston. Most immigrants coming to America sought the fertile soil west of Boston, or the greater merchant and industrial opportunities found in the burgeoning American cities. Most had little money to get to their desired destination. The potato famine in Ireland that began in 1845 changed all that. So despite Boston being one of the merchant hubs of the New World, again, as this goes into in many other articles, it really wasn't that desirable to be here. The quote-unquote free real estate of the West was really like the big pull, that you can actually go off to what was marketed as uninhabited lands, as we know were fully habited with Native Americans, but they didn't view those people as people, and to go take, you know, your own land, your own kingdoms away from the cramped areas of Europe and then, you know, the cramped areas of Boston. So it was really just the poor migrants who could be here. And just to read you a little, I found an honors thesis written in 2011 titled Stratified Boston, the Brahmins, the Irish, and the Boston Police Strike of 1919. Can't obviously get to the police strike. That definitely deserves its own episode. This paper was written by Sarah Block from Bucknell University. Felt she did a great job. And just wanted to read from you her section, which kind of mirrors what I just read from you from PBS. Boston offered few advantages for entrepreneurs, further increasing the homogeneity of the city's population during this early era by attracting relatively few newcomers as either employers or laborers. Entrepreneurs hesitated to undertake new ventures in Boston due to the lack of cheap available labor. Now that's about to change when we get the massive Irish immigration. As industry boomed in other Massachusetts cities, Boston had a difficult time matching their success. As a result of the lack of innovation and industrial development in the city, proper few workers successfully found employment in Boston. Not surprisingly, workers shied away from the city in favor of places with an abundance of job openings. Immigrant workers particularly looked to towns developing as hubs of the textile industry. Think of like Lowell, which had been positively affected by the Industrial Revolution. They merely passed through Boston, seeing it solely as their point of entry into the country, not as the final stop on their pursuit of the, quote, American dream, unquote. By 1845, Boston was still a town, quote, of small traders, of petty artisans and hands craftsmen, and of great merchant princes. So we always still had, like, you know, John Hancock, for example, is one of the wealthiest people in the colonies. He was a trader. Like, so we still had some very, very wealthy people here in Boston, the Adams family, Sam Adams, you know, also in particular. But outside of that, relatively uneven economy, and the rest of the country was rapidly advancing beyond Boston, both economically and technologically. This changed very little over the following decades, resulting in a lack of development and lack of economic progress in Boston in comparison to other American cities. By the time immigrants began to arrive en masse, they entered into a uniquely unvaried community with little diversity. And here is where we enter the potato famine, which, of course, as people, I'm sure, very well aware, was an artificial famine. Ireland at the time believed their population was roughly 9 million people. They were producing enough food to feed all 9 million. However, they were a colony of the British Empire, and England was absorbing all of that food, leaving the Irish with not enough food to eat. That is what caused the famine. Yes, there was like a potato disease, which just made it much worse, but they were still producing enough food to feed their people, but they were a colony. I'm just going to read from you back from that PBS. The Great Famine struck in Ireland that was already struggling. Oppressive English rule had crippled many of the Ireland's merchants and drawn the Irish elite to England and prevented Ireland from reaping the benefits of the Industrial Revolution that swept Europe and America. The lower classes of Ireland were struggling to get by, and the potato famine devastated them. Thousands came to America between 1845 and 1850, and Boston was one of the main seaports of their landing. Many Irish immigrants barely had the means to make the trip and had no money to move on once they landed in Boston. By 1850, 35,000 of Boston's 136,000 residents, 26%, were Irish. So over a quarter of Boston's population by 1850 was Irish. And now this continues, and this brings us to the topic of the day. Most of the arriving Irish were of the poorest classes of Ireland and did not have the skills of previous immigrants to Boston. The city had no way to absorb them. Many of them turned to selling drink. And by 1851, 900 of Boston's 1,500 liquor shops were run by Irishmen. The temperance movement was failing. Boston's health and safety reforms also lost major ground. Fanned by desperation, overcrowding of immigrants caught in the city without the geographic or economic room to support them. Disease, mortality, crime shot up in Boston. Now, that was true throughout America. If you look at American cities from roughly like 1850 to 1890, we'll call it, people were getting sicker. People were getting shorter, like literally. The weight of industrial capitalism, the crowding of immigrants, before we had any real knowledge of truly how infectious disease spread, things like cholera and typhoid and all that stuff, before, you know, indoor plumbing, which is probably up there with like the top two reasons why our life expectancy skyrocketed in like the early 20th century, because we realized we need to get people away from, you know, waste. And so almost all American cities face this problem. This wasn't just a Boston problem in terms of disease, crime, mortality increasing, all of those things. It was a capitalist problem that we didn't just yet have the technological solutions to work around or to codify. Now, however, when you had now all these Irish coming into Boston and simultaneously things are getting cramper, things are getting sicker, people are coughing more, well, it's not that much of a theoretical jump if you have a 19th century mind to blame those dirty immigrants. Again, nothing is new. What we are dealing with today are the same levels of ignorance that were dealt with in the 19th century, that were dealt with in the later 18th century when, you know, Benjamin Franklin yelling about the Germans. None of this is new, That's one of the most annoying and most frustrating parts of looking at politics today, is none of this is new. And so now we're in the 1850s Boston, and what is this? We have all of these Catholics, they're drinking, they're controlling the liquor licenses, all of a sudden crime is increasing. Again, we have all these people that are being ripped from independent small businesses that now have to go slowly work in these emerging things called factories. People are really no longer able to have these small independent farms where they can grow their own subsistence. They're looking into cities. They all just got kicked out of Europe because of the colonial relationship with the British Empire. And hey, there's now a political reaction and a whole new political party that forms specifically against these immigrants. Enter here the Know-Nothings. Going to read from you a 2017 article from Smithsonian Magazine titled How the 19th Century Know-Nothing Party Reshaped American Politics. And it begins, and there are some great political cartoons of this time period that, I mean, when I say great, like, you know, they're sad because of how much they mirror, like, some of the grotesque imagery, cartoons, language that we see in our national media today. Again, everything is new. This piece, I mean, everything isn't new. Everything just repeats. This article begins with a mid-19th century anti-Irish cartoon, which I'm very confident is probably going to be, takes place in Boston. And it shows two men wearing kind of like the barrels, you know, like the barrels as shirts. One of them called Irish whiskey, the other one called lager beer. So I think that's an Irishman and a German, and they are carrying the ballot box running away. So these immigrants are stealing the ballots. I found a slideshow on our Secretary of State website. This has another great political cartoon from Boston at the time. It's titled The Irish Frankenstein, and it's just like this gigantic, a guy doesn't look like cartoonishly Irish. I don't really know another phrase. He looks kind of like an ape man. With like a dagger and a cloak, and he's just this towering figure. It's just warning, you know, about these dangerous Irishmen that are coming, and some rather portly looking guy in a top hat is like kneeling in fear. But back to the Smithsonian article. Like Fight Club, there were rules about joining the secret society known as the Order of the Star-Spangled Banner, an initiation rite called Seeing Sam, the memorization of passwords and hand signs, a solemn pledge never to betray the order, a pure-blooded pedigree of Protestant Anglo-Saxon stock, and the rejection of all Catholics. And above all, members of the secret society weren't allowed to talk about the secret society. If asked anything by outsiders, they would respond with, "I know nothing." So went the rules of the secret fraternity that rose to prominence in 1853 and transformed into a powerful political party known as the Know-Nothings. At its height in the 1850s, the Know-Nothing Party, originally called the American Party, included more than 100 elected congressmen, 8 governors, a controlling share of half a dozen state legislatures from Massachusetts to California, and thousands of local politicians. Party members supported deportation of foreign beggars and criminals, a 21-year naturalization period for immigrants, mandatory Bible reading in schools, and the elimination of all Catholics from public office. They wanted to restore their version of what America should look like with temperance, Protestantism, self-reliance, with American nationality and work ethic enshrined as the nation's highest values. What I want you to imagine in your mind is the movie Gangs of New York, where you have this group of people who call themselves the nativists, who view themselves as like the true Americans, which again, like the language these people use. And that was still like the language of the time. It's just so ridiculous. Like, you know, to us, which is like a modern interpretation of American history, that like these white Protestants are calling themselves the natives of America, you know, with Daniel Day-Lewis, and you have Leo DiCaprio and Liam Neeson as like the organization of immigrants in New York and their conflict, which goes from about like the 1850s until I think that movie ends around the Civil War. But it really can't be overstated how much Massachusetts was like the Know-Nothings home base. So reading from you a paper written by Stephen Taylor called Progressive Nativism, the Know-Nothing Party in Massachusetts. This is published back in 2000 in the Historical Journal of Massachusetts. In no state did the American Party reap as much success as in Massachusetts. In 1854, the party captured the governor's office, the entire state senate, and virtually the entire state house of representatives. The American Party, which again is like the same name, also took over the city of Boston and other municipalities in the Bay State. Once in office, the party not only passed legislation that reflected the anti-immigration positions of the National Know-Nothing movement, but the party also distinguished itself by its opposition to slavery, support for the expansion of rights of women, regulation of industry, and support of measures designed to improve the status of working people. So without getting too much into it, looking at these conflicts between what are otherwise seen as progressive values and very harsh anti-immigrant stances. Different topic for a different day. But the point being that this rise of Irish immigration into the city was met with a massive political backlash in terms of trying to kick out all the immigrants and all the Catholics, and focusing on alcohol. And eventually, spoiler alert, while the Know-Nothing Party was a very successful third party, I think probably the most successful, at least up to that point in American history, maybe ever, it eventually split apart with the rise of the Republican Party to counter the Democrats in what eventually will be the Civil War. But this coalition of a political formation was also mirrored and matched with the creation of a social grouping, which now finally brings us to the Boston Brahmins. So who were these Brahmins, and where does this term come from? I'm going to read from you literaryboston.com. Oliver Wendell Holmes and the Boston Brahmin. And now this is Oliver Wendell Holmes Sr., not to be confused with his son, Oliver Wendell Holmes, who everyone will eventually know as the Supreme Court Justice. I know him as the guy who coined the phrase, three generation of idiots is not enough, and his strong support of the eugenic movement. But he is still widely celebrated by Harvard to this day. Anyway, his father, a little bit of an author. He also wrote the poem Old Ironsides, which basically saved us getting rid of the USS Constitution, so he got to maintain that little landmark. But now reading from the article, Holmes also coined the term the Boston Brahmin in his 1861 novel, Elsie Venner. Now, I've also seen it written that he actually first used it a year before, but I think this has to do with like how novels were created, where originally they were just chapters that were individually published in periodicals, and then people figured out, hey, why don't we just take all these isolated chapters, throw them together in a novel? That's kind of like how Moby Dick was formed. So, but regardless, this is the guy who created the phrase. Back to the sentence. He entitled the first chapter, The Brahmin Caste of New England. In the Indian caste system, the Brahmin caste is the highest, most elite segment of society. In New England, the term referred to the old, wealthy families of Boston. The term encapsulated the status of a family's roots, but also their dignity, their societal connections, their philanthropy, and their appearance in society, etc. Usually, the men in the family attended the same schools, usually the same families were marrying one another. Some examples of family names, which you'll recognize if you're from the area, are Adams, Cabot, Coffin, Elliott, Emerson, Endicott, Forbes, Gardner, Holmes, Lawrence, Lowell, Otis, Parkman, Peabody, Phillips, Putnam, Quincy, Weld, Wigglesworth, and Winthrop. So again, we have this massive Irish immigration into Boston. We now have political formations met against them. This is now met with new social groupings. So now we have the early 1860s describing this formation of these elite families that want to distinguish themselves from this rising herd of immigrants. And to go further on this, a 2004 article in Slate.com, What's a Boston Brahmin? Holmes counted himself a Boston Brahmin. In large part, he used the term to refer to families who produced generation after generation of scholars at institutions like Harvard. Harvard plays a very big role in this formation. He contrasted this race of scholars, and I guarantee you in the 1860s, when they say race of scholars, they're literally meaning people with like a biological aptitude for knowledge, whose aptitude for learning was congenital and hereditary. I swear to God. Didn't finish the sentence reading it, but I knew that's what they were going to say. Awesome. With what he called the common country boy, whose race has been bred to bodily labor. However, Holmes also thought there was room in elite circles for hardy country boys who gained an education. Their better health could be useful in certain cases. Again, like you really can't distinguish this from the eugenics movement. And I want you to continue to center that what we are talking about in this episode is Boston's relationship to the State House. And how concepts like eugenics, like those people because of their biology or maybe their culture makes it so embedded, don't get to make decisions for themselves. We have to make it for them. Those, what was very, very real and the highest held beliefs of what were seen as the most intelligent and educated people of society, that biologically there are some groupings that are better than others, and the ones that sit atop the hierarchy, the Brahmin, should be the ones in control. This is the ideological core of what shapes the state house relationship to Boston to this day. These concepts don't go away even if they just transition. They're there just under the surface. And this class has also a very lovely poem called A Boston Toast by John Collins. Bozity? And this is good old Boston, the home of Bean and the Cod, where the Lowells talk only to Cabots, and the Cabots talk only to God. With the Lowells and the Cabots being two of like the major families in these like little Brahmin circles. And now just to read from you a little bit back from that honors thesis paper. Harvard played an essential role in reinforcing and perpetuating the sense of superiority and exclusivity expressed by the Brahmin community. Not only did Brahmins have an unusually high regard for the university and its community, Harvard became a large part of the elite Boston's adult life and identity. And this really goes into what the combat zone focuses the narrative around, which is the death of a Harvard boy who is part of a Harvard tradition, goes to the combat zone like the last night of the team's football season to, you know, go to a strip joint, get drunk, and go home. And how, again, these elite circles, these fraternal orders, these traditions, how they overlap and intermeld with status and class. Anyway, keep reading. The high reputation of the university fit perfectly into the Brahmin understanding of a world based on status and prestige. Rising costs and classical admissions examinations, two factors that made admission all but impossible for those who were not members of the city's elite class, forced Harvard to become an exclusionary tool of the elite and reinforced Boston's emergent social class system. In fact, the rise of Harvard helped to create and bolster a more cohesive Brahmin class as a result of the increasing homogeneity of the student body. A Harvard education taught people upper-class values while simultaneously distancing and distinguishing these people from the middle and lower classes, namely those without the same educational and cultural opportunities available to them. However, and now this is when we start to get to it, the Brahmins are a small group of people. We still have a rising and rising immigrant population into the city of Boston, which at this time is, I still believe, primarily Irish immigrants. And throughout the entire second half of the 20th century, we have more and more liberal voting policies allowing more and more people to partake in the act of political expression. And now to read from a Boston Magazine article, No Irish Need Apply, from 2006. And whether they stay in Southie and Dorchester or move to Dilton and Dedham, the Irish remain unfailingly reliable voters. They came and they began to vote, says Thomas O'Connor, a Boston College historian and author of The Boston Irish, and they continue to vote. The Irish cemented their long and impressive rise to political power in Boston with the election of Hugh O'Brien as mayor in 1884, and broadened their influence with the ascendancy of U.S. House Speaker Thomas P. Tip O'Neill, the Kennedys, and others. And it all began with this election of Hugh O'Brien. So he was born in Cork County, Ireland, 1827, emigrated when he was to Boston when he was 5 years old. And I'm getting this from a blog post on irishboston.blogpost.com from 2007. I can't see the author's name. He worked in printing, 1875. He was selected to the Board of Aldermen. And in 1884, he ran and defeated incumbent Boston Mayor Augustus Martin, being officially sworn in January 1885. And, of course, Boston's first Irish-born mayor. And, oh, okay, I guess I understand how this makes sense. At this time in Boston's history, we had a Boston election every single year. It was a one-year term, which is insane. But he was then elected again in 85, 86, 87, and narrowly lost in 1988. And here's how the Globe reported on it at the time, meaning his first election. All over the city, the Irish felt a natural pride that one of their countrymen should stand so high in the esteem of the people. But as I mentioned, he was knocked off in 88, and then 4 years later, the next Irish mayor was elected, Patrick Collins, 1902-05. And now, finally, we have John F. Fitzgerald, 1906. And it was this election which finally drove the Protestants insane. They saw that Boston was becoming more and more of a Catholic Irish powerhouse, and they decided to retaliate. Reading from The Thirsty Games, written in 2016, at the Boston Institute for Nonprofit Journalism by Haley Hamilton. Boston's been torn up about liquor licenses for a long time. In 1906, the city elected Mayor John Honey Fitz Fitzgerald, John F. Kennedy's maternal grandfather and an Irish-American politician who was famous for championing the working man, at least publicly. The victory caused an uproar in the old money and Yankee-dominated statehouse. According to city lore and many books and articles written on the subject, to limit the power of the Irish mayor, Brahmins in state office placed various arbitrary restrictions on Boston officials. And remember, what was one of those big restrictions that they changed in 1906? They changed the power to appoint the members of the licensing board from the mayor to the governor, which again was not a power that we got back until over 100 years later, just being able to pick who sits on our own licensing board. And with this election, with the law change in 1906, I think we're going to stop it here for today. I know it's a little bit shorter of an episode than I normally do. There was just a lot of history that I needed to get through to try to get us to understand Boston's nightlife, our relationship with the statehouse, all of this. But really, that major takeaway that I want you to have is that our relationship to the statehouse is 100% connected to the Protestant eugenics movement of the mid to late, really the peak of the eugenics movement was like the early 20th century, but just go with me. Of Boston against the Irish, against Catholics, against immigrants. And it is that formation that there are elites who know better by blood, by culture, and that they have the right to tell others what to do with their own lives. That people cannot govern themselves. It is for the elites, the betters, the Brahmins to do it for you. And that is what governs and anchors our relationship to the statehouse to this day, and it's why we have to go begging hand and foot with home rule petitions still to this day. And it shouldn't be lost, the racial components, not just of our mayor, of our city council, but how that looks in terms of Boston and the demographics of the statehouse. These things haven't changed. We just use different vocabulary to describe them. And I don't know if I'll do part two next week. I have some interviews I'm trying to line up, but we're going to stop the liquor licenses here, 1906. We'll talk a little bit about the prohibition movement in Boston once we, 21st Amendment, we got to drink again. What did Boston as a city, how it radically changed post-World War II? Because that is after the Brahmins, I think like the second most important thing to understand is how much Boston was ripped apart in the post-World War II era. And then we'll finally get to the combat zone of the 1970s, and we'll look at how that change and everything that happened with that social experiment, as it's called, governs and dictates Boston's nightlife today. So that'll hopefully maybe all be in a part two. Maybe this will be a multi-part series about Boston's nightlife. I don't know. I hope you learned something. I hope you found this informative. And as always, if you would like to support the show, if you'd like to support me and everything that I do, the best way to do that, patreon.com/bostopianews. You can subscribe for as little as $4 a month. There are other tiers if you want to buy me like a beer once a month, it's $8. If you want to buy me a sandwich, I think it's like maybe 15. I think it's a $20 like lunch tier. I don't know. Give what you can. Each time I get that notification, I can't tell you how happy it makes me of just more and more people buying in. It makes me want to just invest more and more time into this. And if you can't, you don't have the means to do so, I fully understand sharing this around. Again, the more people that listen, just the more valuable than I think this resource is for people. And with that, I will see you next Monday. And as always, have a great rest of your day.